The latest White House strategy for thinking about extremism is apparently a plan not to say the word Islamic when talking about terrorists. Okay. While policymakers in Washington, D.C. focus on alternative messages to extremism as at the extremist summit in Washington, D.C., ISIS, the self-described throwback to the Middle Ages, this distorted version of Islam invented by armed terrorists, ISIS advances across the Middle East into Libya and parts of Egypt. From the rubble of Aleppo to the violence of Fallujah, this land was made for who or what? Catchy little tune there. What is it, actually, that ISIS is all about? ISIS Nation, a territory as big as Jordan. What's it like to actually live there? How would it actually function? Joining us now is Torbjørn Soltvedt, who's a principal analyst for Middle East and North Africa at Verex Maplecroft, a risk analysis group in the UK. Torbjørn, welcome.
Thank you.
So if you're just a citizen in this territory in between Syria and Iraq, or composed of Syria and Iraq, and try to keep your head down and just basically get by, what is your life like, as far as we can gather at this point, under ISIS?
Yeah, from what we can gather, the main thing really is that it's getting increasingly worse for people living under the Islamic State. A very good example is the city of Raqqa in Syria, a city of about 200,000 people or so. And this is really the first city where the Islamic State was able to establish full control. So it gives us a good view of how the Islamic State would like to run a city and to what extent it is able to do so. And what is becoming increasingly clear is that the people who are living in Raqqa and in other cities under the control of the Islamic State is that they are really struggling to provide basic services. Electricity is down to maybe an hour a day or perhaps less. Water quality is deteriorating. People are living under severe repression and extreme reprisals, which is the primary form in which the Islamic State, you know, enforces its control and manages to stay in control. So whereas the group initially was doing sort of programs that were less controversial, perhaps providing bread at cut prices, providing fuel at cheaper prices, once it then goes on to try and really sort of govern a city, then that's where it starts to struggle, because it doesn't have the required personnel, the required technical people to run a modern city.
And it sounds like, from what you're saying, the experience of Raqqa teaches us that people who are responsible for the infrastructure, like electricity, they flee in the face of control by ISIS. What about What about people in the markets selling produce, or pharmacists, those sorts of people?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. A lot of these people, of course, have fled as well. If they can, other people, then they have to stay. I mean, this is where they live. This is where they have their lives. So really, if you look at the Islamic State interference in everyday life, it's extreme. And you mentioned pharmacists. You know, for instance, in Raqqa, we've seen Islamic State enforce these sort of religious seminars, religious schools for pharmacists that they have to attend in order to be allowed to carry on operating their businesses. You know, they have to sit an exam and have to prove that they have to have sort of the required knowledge of sort of Sharia law, of Islamic law. So it's really sort of an extreme interpretation of Islamic law and an extreme enforcement of that. So it really kind of reaches every single aspect of people's everyday lives.
We've talked a lot on this program about how ISIS is funded by oil wells that it controls in Syria and other sources, including antiquities, trade, that sort of thing. Does ISIS collect taxes? And if so, how?
Absolutely. That's as the Islamic State gained a lot of territory. It had a lot of momentum back in sort of mid-2014 was when it really sort of pushed into Iraq. And, you know, as part of that, it was able to generate a lot of money as it you know, conquered new cities, Mosul in Iraq, for instance, a city of over 1 million people. You know, it imposed taxes on local people. Businesses, you know, that are allowed to operate have to pay a tax. You know, trucks and cars coming in with goods have to pay a tax. Religious minorities, you know, if they're Christians, for instance, have to pay a tax. And even, you know, seizing bank accounts. And that has also been in a way in which the Islamic State has tried to bring back some of the sort of the key personnel, engineers, doctors, trying to force them back into the running of these cities. I mean, they've seized people's bank accounts and then try to contact these people saying, if you want to see your money again, you have to return and you have to kind of carry on operating this factory, you have to carry on operating this water treatment plant. Clearly that hasn't worked, which is creating a big problem for the Islamic State.
We're talking with Torbjørn Soltvedt, who's a principal analyst for Middle East and North African affairs at Veresk Maplecroft, a risk analyst group in the UK. You know, one of the things you're describing here is that they've had to set up a separate infrastructure to do some of this collection and functioning. It's very much different from the so-called caliphate under the Ottomans, where you had the Ottoman Empire basically plugging into existing village structures for collecting taxes, a much more, energy efficient and low maintenance approach. They've decided to reinvent the wheel here.
Yes, it's an interesting comparison. I mean, they talk about themselves as a state and as an Islamic state, but you know, it bears very little resemblance to you know, sort of the historic caliphate or even, you know, any modern state. It's a very much a sort of top-down structure of imposing rules and regulations on people. There's not much in the way of incorporating existing structures. It's bringing in quite a lot of the time foreign fighters. In Syria, for instance, there might be Tunisians or Iraqis that are running factories, that are running businesses and overseeing the production of oil and so on. So it's really it's more of an occupation. And that's clearly a problem for the Islamic State. Initially, when they had a lot of momentum, they were moving around in these large convoys, almost as sort of a blitzkrieg without the air support, you know, it's quickly seizing territory. They've lost that momentum now, and they're struggling to govern these cities. So it's become an occupation force. And I think this is having a negative impact on the group's morale. And we've seen reports of people who have turned up from European countries, for instance, to join the Islamic State. And then they see that the reality is very different from what they had imagined. They see the sort of the severe repression, brutality, and also the lack of momentum at the moment. And that's had a very negative impact on the group's morale.
I'll get in trouble for saying this, but it sounds like they haven't learned the lessons of the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. They've got themselves a quagmire.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good comparison. I think when you look back at, you know, the Islamic State's ability to rapidly seize territory in Iraq, a lot of that was down to the Iraqi government's sort of marginalization of the Sunni community. So now Islamic State run the same risk, you know, as during the mid-2000s when the U.S. troop surge alongside the sort of Sunni tribal movement was able to more or less defeat or at least push back these types of group in Iraq. If you look back at al-Qaeda in Iraq, it was more or less defeated until the conflict in Syria emerged, and the Islamic State in Iraq was then able to sort of evolve into what is today the Islamic State. But they don't seem to have learned many of those lessons, which led to their sort of initial downfall in Iraq.
In our final minute here, Torbjorn, do you think there's any chance that ISIS can really invade Iraq or Egypt and Syria and Yemen?
No, I think clearly some of the group's ambitions are, you know, are far too far-fetched. I mean, they have a presence in Egypt, in the Sinai, and that is likely to remain the case. They will be able to exploit the situation in Libya. But beyond that, I don't see any sort of major expansion. I think they are on the back foot at the moment, and I think they will have there will be enough of a challenge for them to just consolidate territory. And I think, you know, conquering more territory at this stage will be very difficult for them.
Torbjorn Soltvedt is a principal analyst for Middle East and North African affairs at Veresk Maplecroft, a risk analysis group. Thanks so much, Torbjorn.
Thank you very much.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.